At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. If your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. Justice Samuel Alito should wake up tomorrow in Gitmo, or in a hospital prison ward being examined for schizophrenia or brain tumors or something. He and the other conservative members of the Supreme Court are as dangerous to the future of this country and its citizens and its freedoms and its form of representative government as any terrorists who have ever lived. I knew the Alito court hearing. We can't call it the Roberts Court. We were reminded yesterday Roberts is an impotent frontman. This is the Alito Court. I knew the Alito Court hearing was going to be bad, and I tried to convey that yesterday. But I honestly did not believe and could not imagine it would be that bad. If presidents knew they might be prosecuted for little things like trying to overturn a valid election and illegally stay in office, Alito told the lawyer representing Jack Smith, they would be way more likely to try to overturn a valid election and illegally stay in office. So, Alito said, if you want to preserve democracy, you can't prosecute a former president for trying to overturn a valid election and illegally stay in office.
What is required for the functioning of a stable democratic society, which is something that we all want? I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully, if that candidate is the incumbent.
That is the constitutional position of the leading justice on the Supreme Court, the justice that Trump's sheep on the court follow. That is Alito echoing virtually word for word things that the mad traitor Trump has posted on his social media feed about persecutions and retributions and even retirement. This is Samuel Alito telling you that the way to ensure peaceful transitions of power is you can't prosecute a lame duck president who partially and nearly fully disrupted the peaceful transition of power. It sounds like something Joseph Heller cut from his novel Catch-22 for being too stupid to be useful as political satire. It is also a blackmail threat. Here's a crazy thought, Sam Alito. If you are actually worried about some sort of cycle of presidents prosecuting the ex-presidents that they have defeated, in large part because the ex-president was corrupt and incompetent and disloyal to the country and a criminal and tried to overthrow the democracy, how about you get your side, Sam? How about you get you and your fascists to stop supporting psychotic criminals like Donald Trump? Or if you just can't dismiss the glorious idea that the ends, that our Republican power do justify the means, namely the utter blasphemy of a Trump presidency, what about instead getting Trump to sign some sort of document in which he forfeits, I don't know, $50 billion if, as president, he tries to persecute Joe Biden? Or maybe, Sam, you could break this cycle that you have conjured out of thin air by, you know, addressing the fact that you, Sam Alito, are personally backing America's Hitler. As these six evil, corrupt, partisan, useless, anti-democracy gangsters on the Supreme Theocratic Court flailed around yesterday looking for an excuse, any excuse, to bury the evidence against Trump and to fix the upcoming election so that he can again seize power, I found myself wishing that they would follow Liz Cheney's plea in the New York Times, that they issue a nearly immediate order. But not in order to eliminate forever the argument that there is presidential immunity, but instead to affirm and establish that there is presidential immunity so that President Biden could immediately arrest the lot of them and Trump and Trump's henchmen. Because what the six conservatives on this destructive fascist court hinted at yesterday was how far they would go to prostitute themselves to rule for Trump in any case that comes before them. We have already seen them erase the clear mandate in the 14th Amendment because they felt it would deny American democracy the right to vote itself out of existence. We have now heard them try to cobble together any bullshit they had in their tiny brains to immunize Trump for his countless crimes. But more importantly, we have now been forewarned that if a case comes before this court relative to this election, these justices will figure out what is best for Trump and then make up the reasons why. They will. You and I may have assumed this, but after yesterday, you and I now know this. This is the Trump attorney, John Sauer, whom Alito and Clarence Thomas and Roberts and the three Trump stenographers were clearly applauding and encouraging and siding with yesterday. And this is Mr. Sauer explaining to Justice Sonia Sotomayor that you can't prosecute a former president for any official act. And yeah, you know what? Trump ordering the assassination of the guy running against him for president? Yeah, that could be an official act. So you couldn't prosecute Trump for assassinating the other guy.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could.
Again, the temptation to say, hey, SCOTUS, go ahead, establish presidential immunity right now. John Sauer's theory that assassination of the opposing candidate is an official act of the president and thus not subject to prosecution? Let's give that some legs. On the bright side, a political assassination ordered by Trump, that would be only one dead guy, right? It's not like Trump ordering a military coup to keep him in office and thus killing civilians along with civilian government in America. It's not like you want us to declare that Trump ordering a military coup to keep him in office and thus killing civilians and civilian government in America is also an official act. Oh, sorry. Yeah, it is. Justice Kagan with Trump attorney John Sauer.
How about if a president orders the military to stage a coup?
I think that, as the Chief Justice pointed out earlier, where there is a whole series of, sort of guidelines against that, so to speak, like the UCMJ prohibits the military from following a plainly unlawful act. If one adopted Justice Alito's test, that would fall outside. Now, if one adopts, for example, the Fitzgerald test that we advance, that might well be an official act, and he would have to be, as I'll say in response to all these kinds of hypotheticals, has to be impeached and convicted before he can be criminally prosecuted.
So a president, and I'm dropping the pretext here, Trump's attorney is talking about Trump. Alito is talking about Trump. Sotomayor and Kagan are talking about Trump. So Trump could have ordered Joe Biden assassinated and not be subject to any criminal prosecution for doing it. And he could have imposed a military dictatorship. And after some kind of, you know, a civil war-ish thingy, he could have been deposed and not killed in the process. And when the newly restored civilian government of the United States of America went to put him on trial for doing all this, oh, sorry, that was an official act of a president. You can't put him on trial just for overthrowing the democracy and establishing a coup and a military dictator. Again, just rule all this into existence now, and let's get all of it out of the way. Because with this court certainly going to delay any ruling on this until July 3rd, and thus postpone even the emulsified remains of Jack Smith's case getting to a jury before the election, I can't think of any other way to stop these Supreme Court bastards from continuing to act as Trump's magic wand whenever he needs one, and I cannot think of any length they would not go to after this election to protect Trump. And, oh, by the way, remember the idea that June 30th or July 3rd was itself an optimistic date for a ruling of any kind in this case by the Supreme Court? Remember the premise that these whores could make it even worse and delay the whole thing for months more beyond that, well into 2025, by use of remand, sending it back to Judge Tanya Chutkan and making her run the charges against some kind of checklist of maybe this is an official act, maybe this is an official act. And then she rules, and then Trump appeals to the D.C. Court of Appeals, and then it goes back to the Supreme Court 6 months from now. Guess which one of the terrorists in robes got to turn that rumor into reality? Yes, the first paralegal ever appointed to the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Handmaid's Tale Barrett.
You say even if the court were inclined to recognize some immunity for a former president's official acts, it should remand for trial because the indictment alleges substantial private conduct.
Yes.
And you said that the private conduct would be sufficient.
Yes.
The special counsel has expressed some concern for speed and wanting to move forward. So, you know, the normal process, what Mr. Sauer asked, would be for us to remand if we decided that there were some official acts immunity and to let that be sorted out below. It is another option for the special counsel to just proceed based on the private conduct and drop the official conduct.
That's great, Amy. Break the case in half and just drop all those official acts from the prosecution. So now, when Judge Chutkan somehow says, yes, this charge and this one and this one and this one and this one, they are not official acts, they're private acts. So Trump can be prosecuted on these. Trump can then start new lawsuits over each decision she makes and keep the case in the courts until the year 2100, when you Christo-fascists are carrying around his stuffed body and claiming that even though he was born 154 years ago and is now dead, he's still president because he's just that good at it. To be fair, the Barrett idea, sorry, the idea they had Barrett express. It's clear Barrett has never had an idea in her life other than how to express more enthusiasm when she says, we've been sent good weather. The idea Barrett expressed contains the only germ of a sliver of a chance of a possibility that there will be any kind of Trump presidential election subversion trial before the election. The special counsel's office lawyer seemed to be completely ready to proceed with a case that only pertains to Trump's personal acts, so long as his official acts could still be used as evidence. I mean, what the hell? One conviction on one charge could be enough to put Trump behind bars, at least until Alito figures out a new scam. It's almost as if Jack Smith saw this coming. I hope to God he did, because I did not. As I said, I'm now over here in the declare there is presidential immunity and have Biden send Trump and the Alito Six to Gitmo camp. Oh, and by the way, go in grace. And now to summarize the nightmare at the Supreme Court yesterday, let's turn to our special legal analyst.
The U.S. Supreme Court had a monumental hearing on immunity and the immunity having to do with presidential immunity. And I think it was made clear, I hope it was made clear, that a president has to have immunity. You don't have a president or
monumental immunity.
and immunity having to do with immunity.
Do you see what happens? Do you see what happens when you keep him from falling asleep in court? In that court, it started yesterday with the prosecution demanding he be found in contempt for remarks about Cohen and Pecker and sliming the jury, remarks he literally made on the way into court minutes earlier, and then the entire subject of the gag order, and even some kind of metaphorical warning shot from Justice Mearsheim, the subject just vanished, never came up again all day at 100 Center Street. Though, Mearsheim now says he will conduct another hearing into the gag order and its violations next Wednesday. Because as any judge would obviously conclude from what was said at the Supreme Court yesterday, what's the rush? There was a lot of Pecker testimony about buying and selling stories and Trump refusing to reimburse him for the bribe to Karen McDougal. And yes, that was a lot of talk about Trump stiffing Pecker. And all Trump's defense has, by the way, is that Pecker met with prosecutors on August 2, 2018, but he does not remember the exact date. Therefore, something. Perhaps most interesting from the courtroom was a text by then National Enquirer editor-in-chief Dylan Howard to an unidentified relative, which the prosecution read. It was sent the night Trump was elected. Quote, he's just been named president-elect. At least if he wins, Dylan Howard writes, I will be pardoned for electoral fraud. You may have heard that before the trial resumed in Manhattan yesterday, Trump had another one of these spontaneous interactions with real people. Like at the bodega last week in Harlem that turned out to be entirely staffed by members of Young Republicans for Fascism. This time it was construction workers at Park and 49th who just happened to be wearing Trump merch. Sadly, most media, especially the news operations in New York, did not recognize that this was an AstroTurf event, even with them all wearing hats with Trump lettering on it. Even after the Fox Morning Show team foolishly asked its not very bright reporter on the scene, Alexis McAdams, how all these construction workers found out about Trump being there. And she let the cat out of the bag and she explained it had been prearranged by the Trump campaign and all the guys you saw on camera had been vetted. By the way, if that reporter's name, Alexis McAdams of Fox News, if that sounds familiar, remember the Bentley that went airborne at the International Bridge at Niagara Falls just after Thanksgiving and Fox reported it had sources who had confirmed it was a terrorist act and the car was full of explosives, and then they began to speculate that it was a Hamas attack on the U.S. The Fox reporter who had the sources confirming it was terrorism and a car full of stuff, oops, it was really just a bad driver and a horrific accident, that reporter was Alexis McAdams. And she still works there. There was news of a third Trump case yesterday. He will not get a new trial in the second E. Jean Carroll case, the $80 million award, at least not from Judge Lewis Kaplan. Honestly, we have to number all the court cases. I have lost track. In Trump-adjacent legal news, plea deal for ex-Marine John Perez, who was stalking former FBI lawyer Lisa Page. This is an example of the results of Trump stochastic terrorism. Last December, this Perez showed up at least four times at Lisa Page's home, once interacting with her son. This was after the FBI had assured Page that he was no threat to her. She is still outraged, and she should be. The deal they made with this guy only bans him from the D.C. area for the next 6 months and insists that he goes to therapy six times. A polling note. The swing towards Biden is so big that even 538.com has begun to sit up and take notice. Its average of national polls, it says, is now tied. A month ago, it was Trump plus two.
The state by states still has Trump ahead in the swing states, but if you think Trump is not panicking, you are wildly mistaken. He posted a graphic late yesterday after court. Trump crushes Biden in Pennsylvania. And beneath it, Trump 47%, Biden 46%. 47 to 46 is crushing only if you are panicking. And to tie all this together, for years, I have wondered when Trump would hit what marathoners call the wall. That moment in the race when your stamina meets age and exhaustion and pain and gravity, and you discover to your dismay, oh, look, gravity works. This was Defendant J. Trump as he reached the cameras after the day ended in court in New York yesterday. And you know how old he sounds? He sounds 206.
Thank you very much, everybody. Today was breathtaking. In this room, you saw what went on. It was breathtaking. And
breathtaking. You bet your ass. Trump's words may not be planned, and they are hardly logical, but never think they are random. He said it a couple of times. He was having trouble breathing. There might be another explanation for that, however, other than the possibility that the proverbial sand is running out in his hourglass. Next time you hear Trump complain that the trial keeps him off the campaign trail, CNN is reporting that he spent the day off from the trial Wednesday playing golf in New Jersey. Also of interest here, never before have all of the medalists in worst persons come from one newspaper and earned their spots because of one article about that one newspaper. The New York Times is not going to go out of business if you cancel your subscription, but it just has given you three more reasons to cancel it anyway. Clueless scumbags, unaware that their pomposity could cost us democracy. The New York Times scumbags. That's next. This is Countdown.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
On this edition of Countdown, Fridays with Thurber and without Trump and without politics and without anything resembling Trump or politics, Thurber's quiet, subtle condemnation of a practical jokester from hell, meet Birdie Doggett next. First, still more new idiots to talk about, the daily roundup of the miscreants, morons, and Dunning-Kruger effect specimens who constitute today's worst persons in the New York Times. And as I teased, something special. All the winners today come from the same newspaper, your New York Times. And they come from the same article about the same newspaper, a piece by Eli Stokels in Politico. I am a daily critic of Politico, but occasionally it does catch lightning in a bottle. And very deftly, in fact, this fits in with this week's Thurber story. It's subtle, and you never really notice the knife drawn, let alone plunged. Politico lets the New York Times destroy itself on one topic. The piece is about why the Times has what is obvious to everyone else except people at the Times, a grudge against President Biden, and why it is actually slanting its coverage against him, even though other parts of the newspaper appear to be aware occasionally that the democracy is at stake and any gratuitous criticism of Biden, like the Times' weekly piece on how old he is or its weekly stupid column by Maureen Dowd, how that increases the chances that we'll have, you know, a dictatorship next January. I have said here repeatedly that it is clear that the people who run the New York Times think they will somehow be issued passes that will keep them from going to the Fred Trump Memorial Media Re-education Concentration Camp with the rest of us. I mean, they really simultaneously perceive the threat, and yet they don't seem to remember they would be among the first or second group of people to be punished or persecuted or prosecuted or literally rounded up, because whatever petty, childish complaints they have about how Joe Biden deals with them and however Biden and the White House really feel about the times, guess what? Trump and his monstrous fascists really don't like the times and would like to see its building burned to the ground. The Stokels piece for Politico points out episodes in which the White House might have been nicer or more generous or fed the Times' unimaginably large opinion of itself a little more. But mostly it just lets key Times people hoist themselves with their own petards. And the three who are the biggest petards are our worst persons medalists today. The bronze, worse, Elizabeth Buemiller, Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. I know you've never heard of her. I've heard of her. People in the business have heard of her. She's Northwestern. She's Columbia journalism. She was the White House correspondent, so in Times land, she's a Hall of Famer. And one day in March 2023, somebody at the Times DC bureau screwed up. He wasn't a regular White House reporter, so when he asked a Biden administration spokesman for a quote late one night on a story, the spokesman emailed one back on background, meaning you could say it was from the administration, but you could not say who personally said it. It's silly, stupid kind of rules, you know, like the way figure skating used to start with school figures, where the skaters had to prove that they could trace figure eights into the ice before they could actually dance. But these guys still have the journalistic equivalent of school figures. They still perform these stupid rituals. And the Times guy screwed it up. He wrote a 7 instead of an 8. He printed the spokesman's name. He attributed the quote that was supposed to be on background. Well, the White House got pissed. It asked to speak to the Times White House editor, and the same guy who screwed up the quote now screwed up again and gave them the wrong phone number. Not the number of the Times White House editor, but the number of the Times Washington editor, Her Honor Queen Elizabeth Buemiller. According to Politico, Buemiller, quote, expressed dismay that the issue had been escalated to her level, was reluctant to alter a story that had already been online for over 12 hours. When the White House tried to bring up another concern with the story, Buemiller just hung up. As Politico explains, there have been bad feelings ever since, bad feelings at the Times. The Washington bureau chief of the Times is so important that when she felt like the problem and the person calling about the problem from the White House were beneath her, she hung up on them, and the Times is mad at the White House because the Washington New York Times bureau chief hung up on the White House. They're not being realistic about what we do for a living, Politico quotes Elizabeth Buemiller as telling them. You can be a force for democracy, liberal democracy. You don't have to be a force for the Biden White House. I think the technical term for that is ass clownery. When exactly do you plan to start being a force for liberal democracy, Elizabeth Ass Clown Buemiller? The runner-up, worser, Peter Baker. I don't know how many times I've mentioned Peter Baker here and in other venues. I know he hasn't noticed because my podcasts are not available to him up there on his high horse. He is one of those Times guys, not just from the Times, but he's one of the ones at the Times who withheld news of the Trump administration debacles until he could get a book deal. He also once insisted that Joe Biden's job had been made more difficult by, quote, a tough column by David Ignatius. Well, that's a good way to start to assess Peter Baker. He thinks stuff written by long-forgotten pontificators in the Times is what makes life difficult for the president of the effing United States. Not fascism or Trump or insurrections or the Supreme Court or Putin or the Republicans or North Korea or climate change. No, David Ignatius is making life difficult for Biden. Anyway, the Politico piece has two wonderful vignettes re-emphasizing how clueless and condescending Peter Baker is. It's Baker who's written most of the Biden age stories. He told Politico, quote, "Every White House I've covered complains about our coverage. It comes with the territory. But because of Trump, there's this new assumption that the New York Times and other media are supposed to put their thumb on the scale and take sides. And we don't do that." I am reminded suddenly of my favorite TV news promo of all time. The BBC ran this for a year. It featured their Washington bureau chief, arrogant and disconnected from reality as Peter Baker is, and as she walked through the streets of D.C., condescendingly insisting that the BBC could be trusted and nobody else could because the BBC had never taken sides in any election or story or war. These words appeared as giant sculptures behind her on the streets she traversed. The first time I saw this promo, I burst out laughing. I actually wrote somebody I knew at the BBC and said, "Are we sure about this? The BBC never took sides in any war? How about that one war when it was sending out secret coded messages to British troops in the newscasts and secret coded messages to resistance fighters around the world in their music shows? I mean, you know that big war? What was it called? The big war with Hitler, where Hitler was specifically sending bombers to London to blow up the building the BBC was in. The BBC was an actual written Hitler target. What was that? World War something? What was it called that they took side? What was it? Come on. World War 12? Something with a 2 in it. Did you take sides in that one? They eventually killed the promo. Well, I hope you damn well did take sides in that promo. And Peter Baker, because of Trump, there's this new assumption that the New York Times and other media are supposed to put their thumb on the scale, take sides, and we don't do that. Hey, guess what? You're wrong. You don't have to treat other people fairly if they're trying to kill democracy and kill the Constitution and kill free press. And oh, by the way, kill you, Peter Baker. This isn't a game.
We don't do that. We don't put our thumb on the scale.
It's not a scale. These guys were at the Supreme Court yesterday insisting assassinations and military coups were all part of their president's official duties. You think wiping out the New York Times is going to take more than half a day under President Dictator Heil Hitler Trump? And oh, by the way, Baker, nobody is asking you to put your thumb on the scale. They're asking you to take it off the scale and to stop doing unethical, unjournalistic things like covering up Donald Trump's malfeasance in office and keeping it out of your goddamned newspaper until you get your book advance. And by the way, it isn't your thumb you've put on the scale, Peter Baker. It's your schlong. Zip it up, boy. But our winner, the Times boss, the publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, who got the Times for free. The newspaper, writes Politico, carries its own singular obsession with the president, aggrieved over his refusal to give the paper a sit-down interview that publisher A.G. Sulzberger and the other top editors believe to be its birthright. It gets worse. Last May, when Vice President Kamala Harris arrived at the newspaper's Midtown headquarters for an off-the-record meeting with around 40 Times journalists, Sulzberger devoted several minutes to asking her why Biden was still refusing. In Sulzberger's view, according to two people familiar with his private comments on the subject, only an interview with a paper like the Times can verify that the 81-year-old Biden is still fit to hold the presidency, unquote. If that's true, A.G. Sulzberger thinks the Times is, you know, like the Supreme Court. But the pièce de résistance in the entire Politico piece about A.G. Sulzberger is an anonymous quote about this publisher who got the Times for free, and about which, once they've read it, the Times is likely to launch, I don't know, a six-month, $887 million internal investigation. Quote, "These Biden people think that the problem is Peter Baker or whatever reporter they're mad at that day," one Times journalist said. "It's AG. He's the one who is pissed that Biden hasn't done any interviews and quietly encourages all the tough reporting on his age. Oh, man. Cancel your Time subscriptions. I did. And I've been a subscriber since 1969. And the New York Times can go F itself. A.G. Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times. Remember, A.G., if Trump wins, at least as they march you off to the camps alongside me and all those Biden press aides, you can go to the gulag happy, knowing that you sure showed Joe Biden today's worst person in the world. I believe the first time I ever heard James Thurber read aloud, it was by William Wyndham, the great actor who did so much serious stuff, drama, comedy. He's a Star Trek original series key figure. He did a lot of great acting in so many different roles, and he did a special on PBS when I was in college in which he performed as James Thurber, narrated some of the drawings, recited from memory many of the short stories and many of the longer ones, too, and I later had the pleasure of telling him that he was my inspiration for reading James Thurber aloud, and we corresponded about how to possibly improve some of the dicier parts of some of the Thurber stories and make them useful for 21st century America. Mr. Wyndham died about 10 years ago, and I lament him still. I recorded on tape his Thurber special on PBS, and I still have it, not videotape, audio tape, a cassette. We didn't have home videotape, although I'm proud to say he sent me a copy of a DVD of the performance. And one of the stories he reads, or in fact recites, I will now read for you. It is, I like it very much. It's not considered part of the great canon of James Thurber, but I think it's terrific. And it's called Shake Hands with Birdie Doggett by James Thurber. John Birdie Doggett, known as Birdie to the few people who speak to him, must be 53 now, but he wears his years with a smirk and he has as bad a practical joker as ever. Other American cut-ups in the grand tradition began to disappear in October 1929, and they are as hard to find now as bison, but Doggett's waggishness has no calendar. You must have run into him at some party or other. He's the man whose right hand comes off when you try to shake it. The late George Bancroft once pulled that gag in a movie, but that was so long ago the picture must be a cherished item in the Museum of Modern Art's film library. Even now, when everybody else was running the gamut of bomb fear from A to H, Birdie Doggett was at Grand Central with one roller skate, which he managed to attach to the shoe of a man sleeping on a bench. When the fellow woke and stood up, he described a brief, desperate semicircle, clutched a woman shopper about the knees, dragged her and her bundles to the cold floor, and was attacked by her muzzled Scotty. Doggett, as always, was the first to lend a hand, helping the woman to her feet, and then turning to the man, "Where the hell's your other skate?" he demanded sharply. "That's what caused all this trouble." He took his skate off the victim's foot and disappeared into the crowd that had begun to gather. "What's the matter over there?" a small man asked him apprehensively. Doggett shrugged. "Oh, they found a woman with a ticking package," he said. The other man turned and left the station, missing the train he had told his wife he would take. Doggett's pranks usually have the effect of involving people on their far edges, one or two of whom have been divorced as a result. A publisher I know thinks Doggett would make a good story. I disagree because I don't think there's anything good about the fellow, but I have done some checking up on him out of force of habit. His father, the late Carol Lamb Doggett, was a Methodist minister, and his mother was a witch. born Etta June Birdie. When her son was only 10, she taught him how to set strangers' umbrellas on fire. After an April shower, she would sally forth with the little hellion, they lived in Dayton, in search of a citizen with a floppy umbrella. After an April shower, Dayton men lower their umbrellas without bothering to roll them. Mrs. Doggett would hunt until she found a man waiting for a streetcar, his umbrella sagging open at his side. She would then surreptitiously fill the umbrella with paper, several dozen kitchen matches, and perhaps one or two ping-pong balls. As the streetcar approached, she would drop a lighted match into the umbrella. Now, hell hath no dismay like that of a gentleman whose wet umbrella suddenly bursts into flame. Instead of rolling the thing to smother the blaze or simply throwing it away, 9 out of 10 men, according to Doggett's statistics, will flail it around in the air, thus increasing the conflagration. Many of Mrs. Doggett's victims were arrested for disturbing the peace or for arson. Birdie Doggett has never been much interested in the exasperating paraphernalia of the trick and puzzle shops. He still uses the wax hand, and he has tried out dribble glasses, whoopee cushions, the foul-smelling stuff you put on chair bottoms to make people think they've just sat on a lighted cigarette, and other such juvenile props. But they never got a real hold on his fancy. He likes the elaborate rib, involving a lot of people. The more, the better. He will take a sackful of cold poached eggs to some crowded Fifth Avenue store at Christmas time and slip them, one at a time, into the pockets of shoppers' husbands. And he dreams of bumping into a woman visitor in the ancient glass and crystal room of some museum, dropping an ordinary table tumbler on the tile floor, and sobbing, "Sweet God, lady, you have broken the sacred chalice of King Alexander!" and making her believe it. He has pulled this gag over and over since 1924, but never successfully, with the result that he has appeared 16 times in Jefferson Market Court alone on charges of disturbing the peace, jostling, and molestation. What Doggett probably enjoys more than anything else is following a couple of women along Fifth Avenue or Madison, keeping discreetly out of sight, but well within earshot, until he hears one of the two ladies call the other by name. He says that women are fond of using each other's full name, as in, "Why, Miriam Shirtle, I never heard of such a thing in all my born days." As soon as Miss Shirtle, let us say, has thus been fully identified, Doggett will walk briskly ahead for several blocks and then retrace his steps. This soon brings him face to face with his quarry, upon whom he will pounce with a delighted, "Why, Miriam Shirtle, fancy meeting you here. Uncross those lovely eyes and tell me how you've been." A young woman he once accosted like this in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, asked him to her house for cocktails in the hope that some member of her family would know who he was. But nobody was home. His hostess turned out to be a bore, so Birdie put knockout drops in her second martini, and after she had passed out, he stole a marble plaque of Kitchener from her mother's room, and he went away. The next day, it arrived at the Shirtles, beautifully wrapped, and bearing a card with the simple legend, "Merry Christmas from the President of the United States." John Birdie Doggett married a tapioca brain one afternoon 20 years ago, possibly because he had lost a bet. Nobody knows. He took her to his house and told her to wait in the living room while he went upstairs and quieted his two Great Danes. He put a record of a dog fight on a phonograph he kept in his bedroom and slipped quietly out the back door. At 3 in the morning, he showed up in the living room with two match players, Lou Gehtling and Vic Talbot. "Who is this disconsolate female?" Talbot demanded, fairly oozing an incurable antipathy to games of chance and cunning. The bride drew herself up stiffly. "I am Mrs. John Birdie Doggett," she said, striving for a hauteur the name will not sustain. "I forgot about her," whined Doggett. "After all, we haven't been married 20 or 30 years. I've only been married 11 hours. Mrs. Doggett, the former Ann Quealy, went home to her mother, Mrs. Paul W. Quealy, and never saw Bertie again. I join her in the fervent hope that he may someday choke on his candied dice and pass forever out of our consciousness. He is a hard man to forget, though. I never start to get out of a chair, no matter where I am, without glancing at my shoes to see if I am wearing one roller skate and feeling in my pockets for old, cold eggs. I've done all the damage I can do here. Thank you for listening. Countdown musical directors Brian Ray and John Philip Chanel arranged, produced, and performed most of our music. Mr. Ray was on guitars, bass, and drums. Mr. Chanel handled orchestration and keyboards, and it was produced by TKO Brothers. Other music, including some of the Beethoven compositions, arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2. It was written by Mitch Warren Davis, and it appears courtesy of ESPN Inc., Our satirical and pithy musical comments are by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today was my friend Jonathan Banks from Breaking Bad, and everything else was pretty much my fault. So that's Countdown for this, the 194th day until the 2024 presidential election, the 1,207th day since Dementia J. Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Use the not regularly given elector objection option. Use the Insurrection Act. Use the justice system. Use the mental health system to stop him from doing it again while we still can and before the Supreme Court stops us. The next scheduled countdown is Tuesday. Bulletins as the news warrants. Till then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. If your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.